Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Good afternoon. The Slapstick Festival has a lovely tradition where you never quite know who's interviewing who. Who's the interviewer? Who's the interviewee? It swaps around all the time. It's much like the film Performance. But it's I'm interviewing Richard Herring, the podcast pioneer, Richard Herring, the author, enormous number of wonderful Edinburgh shows as well in the 90s, and you know all those plays, which I hope some of which will get resurrected at some point.
Be
because
nice.
you worked with relentlessly, I think, you know, brilliantly. And we're basically going to look through all of the things, or at least some of the different influences and things that Richard has gone on to rip off so lovingly over the last few years. Because that's what we all do. Every time you think you've come up with an original joke and then you go, oh, I see the Greeks were doing that. So I'll start off because, you know, like me, and I think a few of the comics that we know, you really are in love with comedy. Well, it's a bit like, obviously, Barry is going to be hovering over us all the time during this weekend in particular. You know, Barry was totally in love with jokes, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I always, I think the two people whose careers I most wanted to emulate and have failed to do so were Michael Palin, who I just think has the most perfect career in terms of doing exactly what he wants and, you know, a broad range of different things, and they're all amazing. And Barry Cryer, in terms of just staying in love with comedy, I mean, he was involved with everything that he possibly could be. But that was the remarkable thing about it, was that he cared about the next generation. He wasn't one of those horrible, pissy, older men who go, why is it all changed? Why are they all swearing? Why are they doing this? He kind of embraced each thing as it came along. And I started off as a comedy fan, and it's nice doing this because most of these things are from my teenage years, I suppose, when I was just enthralled living in Cheddar in Somerset and not being able to get out and see very much stuff live. So films and, you know, and TV shows were my way in, and comedy meant so much to me. And lots of people were into bands, and I wasn't that interested in music, really. I was just really...
It was just Ice-T, wasn't it?
Ice-T came later. We were all into the Sex Pistols a bit too late in Cheddar. But even I,
were you one of those ones where you go, well, the best Sex Pistols song's Friggin' in the Rigging, or something like that?
Maybe. But everything was just a little bit, because, you know, there weren't even bands, and until we could drive, which I couldn't do till I was 26, so that wasn't much good. We couldn't come, you know, we used to come to Bristol for a few things. I think we saw Buzzcocks in London anyway. So, yeah, I didn't really go to many gigs. But so TV and films were it. And I remember, you know, we'd sneak. I can't remember if there's anything. I can't remember what I've chosen now. But we'd sneak into the Wells Odeon when it was still there and pretend we were 18 when we were 14 and go and see soft porn films, but comedy mainly.
To be fair, your first choice, I know, I don't know if you'd have seen it on the big screen. I think it once was on a double bill with Airplane, remarked. You've picked something where you've picked a very innocuous sketch from it, but I know why teenage Richard Herring liked it. That's probably why 20-something and 30-something Richard Herring liked it as well.
This is exactly... I went to see Kentucky Fried Movie, and it was on with a film called The Other Cinderella, which was just a soft porn version of, and this was when it was just before probably the video revolution. So it was literally these 14-year-old boys. We went in the order of when we thought we would get in. So it wasn't. So the last one they went, and who was ironically the oldest, Phil Fry. He was the September baby. He looked really young, and they went, oh, no, not him, not him. And we went, well, yeah, he is. And so there's no way they couldn't have known we were all 14. But my main memory is watching The Other Cinderella and all being slightly overexcited by that concept. But Kentucky Fried Movie also did have an element of soft porn to it, didn't it?
Yeah, it had those sketches where you go, this isn't really a sketch, is it? Catholic high school girls in trouble, I think, is the one you'll remember.
It was hard to find one that I thought, this is. I can't even remember what I chose.
Chosen your favourite, or what we should say is the only one that was acceptable at, you know, pre-Watershed, at the Watershed. And it is, this is your favourite sketch from Kentucky Fried Movie. Let's have a look, shall we?
But, you know, the guys, the Zucker brothers, were behind all that, weren't they? And various other people, I think, in Kentucky Fried Movie. But that whole stream of comedy, which I think has really sort of influenced so many people. But that was the first one, wasn't it? And Top Secret was... I remember going and seeing Top Secret, which was also, I think, after Airplane, was it?
Yeah.
But that didn't really make the same impact. But I remember going to see that with my brother and loving it, just crazy. There's some
one
really...
of them's become a bit nuts, hasn't he? Isn't one of the Zucker brothers just making these kind of awful right wing films about Christmas is banned by atheists and stuff
that? That's a shame. Surely you can't be serious.
But also John Landis, of course, who I think it's in the Mug movie, as far as I remember. Were you one of those teenagers that adored the fact that there was a constant joke in John Landis movies where there would always be a reference to "See You Next Wednesday"?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you know the porn film in American Wealth in London is called "See You Next Wednesday." Even in Michael Jackson's Thriller, there's a moment where he goes, "A message written in blood. It says, 'See you next Wednesday.'" And those kind of utterly, utterly pointless jokes that for teenagers are like kind of, oh, I can't wait to see the little, you know, the Easter egg, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they meant so much, you know, because, again, these things, they were a little bit titillating, obviously, that was part of it as well. But it was, you know, I think really the comedy was the thing that sadly was the most exciting thing about these slightly pornographic comedy shows. But, you know, I mean, it was seeing, I think, again, I mean, because we were a little bit too young for Python in our generation, and I was kind of aware of it, and the films came out, and, you know, we'll talk about that later, I'm sure. So, like, Tiz Was and things like that were our way in, and I just always loved that. That's, I think, been throughout my life, that kind of anarchic comedy that's in Tiz Was, that's obviously in Python, but it's in all the Zucker Brothers stuff as well, has always been the thing that's excited me. And I think the densely packed nature of those of Airplane, just all the jokes going on, and you kind of, when we started doing our TV show, it was really, I just wanted everything to, I wanted there to be so many jokes that you couldn't even take it in. So we even tried to get to get CFAX so we could put different subtitles to the what were on the show. We weren't allowed, but we were going to write a whole different show for people watching, which I suppose is sort of a cruel joke in a way. But it was just that you could watch it and get another layer of jokes.
Well, when did you realise? Because I was thinking of that with something like, you know, Fist of Fun, where you had, like, Python and others, you know, the books were not just here's a load of stuff from the series. Your Fist of Fun book is a fantastic book filled with.
But it's exactly that. It's the disappointment as a comedy fan when you'd get the Christmas book and it would be, you'd open it up and it would be 7 pages long and it would be pictures of the people in a funny hat. You know, we wanted the Python books were amazing. You know, those Python books were so dense and so amazing, and we just wanted it to make sure it was that. You know, I think like the early Not Then and I Caught News ones were great, and then they just sort of got worse and worse, and you know as a comic, like, I think teenagers have the best, because they're so obsessed about things and because it becomes their life, they have the best taste in a lot of ways. You know, I remember when people go, yeah, but only teenagers like your stuff, and you go, great, that's exactly what I want, you know, because those are the comedy connoisseurs. It means something to you. And so I think to feel like you're being ripped off is a horrible feeling from people that so we just, you know, we really wanted to make that book as dense as, you know, and as full of good stuff as possible. And we just had lots of material, because we wrote radio shows. So some of it came out of the radio show, some of it was original. But I mean, things like the thing I love, the cut up football stickers that Stu did, that was on his wall at college. You know, he did that at college one night when he was drunk and made these cut up Panini stickers and just made them into ridiculous characters like McCann McCall, something like that, you know, and just slightly freaky faces. And we just put those in the book, but they're, you know, they're endlessly fascinating because there's so much detail in there. But that's, so yeah, I think that's the detail and the fun, and maybe less of the slightly sexist gratuitous breasts. But yeah,
have you ever seen Amazon Women on the Moon?
No, I have not seen.
Has anyone ever seen that movie?
Yes.
It's a great, it's talking about, but it's also, as well as John Landis, it's Joe Dante, and I can't remember who else. It's got some really cracking, a wonderful Ed Begley Jr., The Invisible Man Returns,
right,
sketch, which is a man who believes he's invisible because he's gone mad from drinking all the chemicals and just wanders around a pub naked. Now, your next clip is Python, and I think it is, for our generation, as you said before, it's like, I don't think I actually saw an episode of Monty Python, probably till I was almost a teenager. It wasn't repeated.
I sort of have a vague memory of seeing some repeat at some point, like I was allowed to stay up and watch it. They might repeat it once. But yeah, it was, you know, now I've got all of Monty Python on DVD and I haven't watched them. I can't, if you get back to the 14-year-old me and say, one day you'll have every single, and it's on all on Netflix, so you can watch every single Monty Python episode. And I haven't watched them all. But I mean, I probably have at some point. But it was, so the films came out and it was very hard to choose anything from the films, because I could have done 12 Monty Python. Which, what have I chosen? Holy Grail or Life of Brian?
Well, I'm going to let it be a surprise time.
Because I went through lots of, but you know, but I think Life of Brian, and I was very lucky to have Michael Palin on my podcast just before lockdown, funnily enough. You know, he's such a, you know, so generous, and but also so happy to talk about. He started doing bits of, I think it's probably this one, he started doing the sketch, you know, in the podcast. And like, some people are like, oh no, you know, I'm not going to do it. He started just doing his own thing. And backstage, we did a backstage interview, and I asked him something about King Herod. It was one of my emergency questions. And he improvised a whole little sketch about King Herod, which you can, if you're a monthly badger, you can watch it in the secret bits of my website. But he was sort of so into it still. But I think Life of Brian, they were all on top form. Graham Chapman wasn't drinking and is brilliant in it. Palin is just, you know, all of those characters that he plays in Life of Brian, you kind of forget they're him until you go back and look at it and go, oh my God, he was that, and he was that, and he was that. You know, you forget that he was all these different characters, and Cleese is brilliant in it. They're all, and the direction is fantastic. So it's them at their absolute prime, though I love Holy Grail as well. But also, I wasn't allowed to go and see Life of Brian. So I had the LP, and I learned that off behind, and we had to sneak. Again, I don't know how my parents would drop us off in Wells and we would say we were doing something else, and then they'd pick us up. And I genuinely don't think they realised. I'm looking back again, they must have known. that we were going. But my parents were very much against me seeing Life of Brian, and so it was like a massive, massive deal to get to see it.
Yes, yeah, strange, isn't it? Because it was. Yeah, I was banned as well. Well, let's have a look at your favourite Monty Python sketch ever, possibly.
We actually, at school, we loved that so much at school. We had a Mr. Cheeky, that character's Mr. Cheeky is the name of that character, Mr. Cheeky. And we had a Mr. Cheeky Award, which was a piece of paper torn out of a reporter's pad, you know, that little reporter's pad, with Mr. Cheeky Award written on it. And whoever did the cheekiest thing that day at school would get the Mr. Cheeky Award. So we were all trying to be as cheeky and rude as Mr. Cheeky. So it was it. So, you know, Eric Idle's amazing in that, and that's the part I talked to Michael about, just that the idea of a sort of kindly middle class man kind of just yes, well done. On we go. It's like a little award ceremony. It's and they're just tricking him. It's great, and the fact that Eric Idle's obviously been through 10 or 15 times already. I know the way.
It's such a... I mean, one of the things that I always find fascinating watching those films is how wonderful they look as well. Mm. Between Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, where you look at the, you know, the Holy Grail, hasn't it? It makes it almost impossible to watch John Borman's Excalibur without laughing because it actually, on no budget, is... And that scene there, just the kind of the darkness and the slight dankness and the shadowiness of it. I mean, I think even things like that get overlooked because very often they didn't look like a comedy film in the way that that kind of very bright lit here are some gags.
No, and it annoys me that comedy films don't ever win Oscars or get nominated for Oscars. I really don't, because I think it's much, much harder to do a successful wall-to-wall comedy film that lots of people are going to like that is genuinely funny than doing something deadly serious. It's kind of easy to be deadly serious. It's easy to do a... don't want to put down all the Oscar winners, but it's comparatively easy to make a subject like the Holocaust quite a sad film.
Mm, yeah.
Whereas it's quite hard to turn, you know, to turn the biblical story into jokes. I mean, it's wall to wall fantastic sketches throughout Life of Brian and Holy Grail. I think just it's just them at their prime, and there's so much you could choose. I'd have chosen the anarcho syndicate peasants from Holy Grail, possibly, but and you know, how much of it's ingrained in your head still as a result of poring over the LPs, usually, wasn't it? Watching, listening to the LPs and learning everything off by heart.
I once ended up having an argument with Eric Idle over the fact that a sketch, he disagreed with me on what sketch, which album it was on.
Right.
And then I realised I really have to stop, because it's the kind of thing that would happen at the Slapstick Festival as well, where someone will come up to you, Rich Herring, and say, well, actually, Rich Herring, my favourite thing that happens in Fist of Fun is in episode 2 of series 1, and it's 12 minutes in. And you'll say, I don't think it is. And then you realise everyone knows it better than you.
Yeah, well, definitely. Due to my troubles last year, I was writing a blog entry about the testicle fairy who would come, you know, if you put your testicle under the pillow, would take your testicle away. And someone said, you'd done that in Fist of Fun. You know, it was this morning, I think, there was an episode this morning where the testicle fairy turns up for my testicle and... You know, careful what you write. It comes true. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
You're a very much a method comedian, aren't you? You really the. I love the fact that from Python, because this is how I got into the argument with Eric, was because one of the quotes when I was doing A level and we had to do King Lear was the bit of King Lear that I know off by heart is from Holy Grail. It's John Gielgud playing to quite an angry, hostile football crowd. Right. Tis this the king?
Aye, every inch a king. When I who stare, see how my subject quays.
And I know the whole of that. Most of the Chaucer or most of the Shakespeare. Shakespeare I can quote is because it was used in Python or in some other comedy
sketch. Saturday afternoon in November was approaching the time of twilight. Thomas Hardy. So, you know, and I talk about Proust all the time. People go, oh, have you read Proust? I go, no, I've just listened to the summarising Proust sketch. So...
Right, now you're next. Now, this one, it's interesting, in terms of Oscars for, you've chosen This is Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Which is... I mean, it's a film that I think every time you watch it, I don't know how many times you've seen it.
I mean, so many.
But I didn't even notice the cold sores until about the 25th time of watching it. You might know that, you know, there's a bit. I just never noticed it because I was watching so many other things.
Yeah,
as you were talking about the number of jokes, that has background jokes, foreground jokes, verbal jokes. There's so much going on.
Yeah, and you don't spot it. And then, every time I watch it, something new will tickle me. It's just because it's the nuance of the performances as well. So often it's just the way someone says something and you haven't noticed it before. I think, in a way, some of the bigger sight gags feel almost too... I mean, they're getting trapped in the pod, almost feel feels too much for the film. It's still very funny, but it is, and you know, there's all the extra. If you buy the extended version, there's an old subplot with the cold sores, and there's a female band they're touring with, I think, or something, isn't it, that they all get off with. So there's so much stuff there, but again, it's so influential on everything that's happened. And again, a film that at the time sort of almost disappeared under the radar. It's become successful as a result of DVDs and bands getting into it. And as a comedian, we would watch this on the Lee and Herring tours at least once a tour. And you would still, there would be bits that, you know, they're walking around backstage trying to find the stage. And we'd always joke about when, you know, oh, here they come, when the girls run past to the fans and they run past the other band. I think we were in Reading, and I think there was just one time these girls actually were waiting for someone. We go, oh, here they come. The girls came up to us and they weren't waiting for someone. We were really confused because that never happened. And we'd already done the joke of, oh, here they come, and then they weren't. But, you know, all those things were so good. But I think that improvisational thing, it's the stuff I'm working with a Welsh director called Jamie Adams at the moment, and he's sort of very much in the Mike Lee, Christopher Guest arena of basically improvising, so having a very minor, having an idea of the story, but then letting the actors just completely go off and improvise. And it gets really interesting stuff. And I think, you know, I think all of the on the hour day to day stuff was all influenced by Spinal Tap, which then influenced so much. And I think if this hadn't existed, I don't think comedy would be the same. I think it's sort of like the Goon Show of not quite our generation, maybe just the generation before our generation, in terms of the influence it's had subsequently, I think.
I'm trying to think of when those brilliant documentary, because also, again, going back to Eric Idle, of course, and Neil Innes with Rutland Weekend Television, you start to see very, very, you know, beautifully done, and then the Ruttles, that spoofing of the documentary form. And if it was anyone here when we showed Bad News at the Old Vic, Bristol Old Vic, and that was such a kind of, there's never been so many Motehead T-shirts at Bristol Old Vic. It was like they all came along. And you know, often the Spinal Tap gets put together, and you go, well, actually, they're entirely separate things, and they're very separate, very different stories.
Yeah,
it's only the fact they're rock bands. Well, let's have a look at your favourite ever sketch from This Is Spinal Tap, probably.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
We're still booing. They were still booing when we were on. You can use those a lot, those lines. That's what I did in real life. But yeah, again, I've gone on for incredible. And I interviewed Harry. I haven't yet interviewed the other two, but he goes right back to, he was in Abbott and Costello films as a kid. So when you interview someone like him, he's much older than you think he is, Harry Shearer. And you know, when you interview someone like that, that's an incredible career to have worked with Abbott and Costello and been in that and been in The Simpsons. And again, so they've all gone on to incredible things, be it afterwards, rightly so. But I think that's just, again, it's just when everything sort of hits right, and they obviously filmed so much for it that they were able to sort of cherry pick. But I think they could have, you know, I'd happily watch 8 hours of it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I wouldn't stand. I could watch, because even when it's boring, it's interesting. And they're so good. And the accents are so good. And that's very, and if you watch Americans doing, I know there's a sort of bit of Britishness in there amongst that, but when you watch Americans doing British people, usually it's, you know, it's not good, is it?
What? I mean,
What's been for you, because you've done so many interviews, you've been doing the podcast for so long, you must have had a moment sometimes where you've been interviewing someone and you're just doing the normal thing and then suddenly your teenage brain goes, you do know who this is and you do know what 15-year-old Richard Herring would have made of this.
And I still, sometimes I'm very, very starstruck, but it was so incredible having Michael Palin on. And he was so nice. I genuinely thought I might cry, to be honest. I was sort of crying thinking about it before I did it. It was sort of all right once I did it, but it's clear that, you know, it's clear that I'm a fan. And but the lovely thing about the podcast is the people I have on are people I like. And, I can't really think of... There might have been times when occasionally someone has been suggested and I've said, I'll give it a go. But nearly always it's somebody I've chosen to be on because I think they're great or I'm interested to find out what they've got to say. So, you know, to when someone like Michael finally comes back and says yes, or when someone like Harry says yes, you know, that's just sort of crazy, yeah. So, yeah, the comedy fan is still there, but hopefully always will be because I'd hate to become blasé about any of it, you know, and I think it's so lovely just to be able to make a career out of the thing that you wanted to do. So whatever level you're at, and I think that's the sort of realisation as you go, and again, and the Barry Cryer interview I did, which just back in sort of September, you know, to see him so happy and still loving comedy, and I think that's the thing. If I stopped loving comedy, and there have been times when I haven't loved comedy or I haven't loved being a comedian, but basically I think it's, you know, it's nice to get new people on, it's nice to get absolute legends on, but it's staying interested, isn't it? I think it's, if you're not interested and if you shut yourself off from people coming up and new stuff coming through, then you're going to have a sort of horrible, bitter, dull life anyway. But it's understanding the progress of it and the fact that things go up and down and some people, you know, I mean, Michael Palin has been at the top all the way through, really, hasn't he? But it's that ups and it's those ups and downs of a career that make it sort of interesting. And and I think the main thing I've realised by doing it is just how many talented people there are out there and how it's a lot to do with talent and skill, but there's a lot of luck about who is the person that pokes through, you know. I had Chris Lineman, who's a fantastic stand-up and very imaginative clown, and he's never had the appreciation he deserves, but he has equally worked for nearly 50 years in the business.
He's a remarkable... If you don't know Chris Lyne, he used to do the greatest show on legs with Martin Sohn and Malcolm Hardy doing the famous The Balloon Dance, which you may well have seen ripped off for various people, and used to end his act with a Roman candle stuck up his bottom on fire, just standing there like that with his genitals tucked in and on fire. And I remember doing a gig with him in Worthing, where he went on last. The gig we'd done the night before in a different town, he'd absolutely stormed it, and the promoter said, who should go on last? And I said, oh, Chris Lyne. And then he went on, and because he's quite a kind of... quite avant-garde, some of the stuff. It's really beautiful, amazing performance art stuff. But if you go for it, it is hilarious and beautiful. But they just did not go for it. And he's doing such... And then he's standing there, he gets as fast as possible, he thinks, I better just get to the Roman candle stuck up the arse then. But by that point, the audience have lost all interest, and he's just standing there. So to stand there, almost on fire, like that, with people not quite booing, but with no interest, and then a woman just shouted out, I'm sure they'd like this kind of thing in Brighton, love. And then that, and it was like kind of...
And imagine not being interested in that. Yeah, even getting not even enjoying that, and then someone does that, you still go, no, still. Still
not. Jimmy Carr did it with a Catherine wheel. Oh, okay.
I think like that. I think in the end, you know, loving comedy and being lucky enough to do it as a job has to be enough for everyone. But I was talking to Mark Watson about this really, because Mark always kind of worried, you know, about where he was and why he wasn't more successful and whatever. But actually, in some ways, it can be a sort of burden to get further than you should. And creatively, you know, he's one of the most creative and imaginative comedians of his generation. And again, isn't as a bigger name as some of the people he worked with. But I think he's come to terms with it and understands that it's actually there's benefits either way. It's lovely to have a thing where people still want to come and see you and where you can keep on doing stuff. I don't quite know where we've got onto that. It's not really true of any of the things we're talking about.
But the and so that brings us very neatly to your next clip, which is the it's. But I know what I find, because I was thinking about the fact that when Barry Cryer used to do a show with Willie Rushton called Two Old Farts in the Night, which I think, by the way, they were younger than us when they did that. And I remember Barry talking about one night where Willie said to him, "You've fallen out of love with the jokes."
Yeah.
And he said he just realised that he was going through the motions.
Yeah.
And he said, "I never allowed that to happen again." Yeah. It would have been sometime, I think, probably late 80s, early 90s. What's the nearest you've come to just thinking, this is not worked out, I'm not... And did you have a moment of standing
on stage?
Yeah, yeah,
there was a lot of time sort of between, because it was a weird thing. We were successful, relatively successful early on, and, we were involved in On the Hour, and so that was an amazing start, and then got our own TV show within sort of 5 years of starting. And I don't think you appreciated... You couldn't appreciate as a someone in their mid to late 20s how lucky that was and that it might stop. So it was quite a big jolt to suddenly for that to end. And I worked with Al Murray for a couple of years and sort of made some money for the first time because we wrote so many episodes. And then I had a period where I was sort of sitting at home, wondering what the point of it all was. And I think even though those tour shows I did in the early 2000s, sometimes you'd just go, I'd be playing in an art centre to 30 people and they really weren't going for it. And you would just put your head down and just say the words as quickly as you could, and you just go, but you sort of realise that's not how you do it. So there was times there where I was thinking, am I going to carry on doing this? What's next? How am I going to go through to the next thing, or am I going to stop? And I think you just realise, no, if you've got a gig like that, you're not blaming the people who've turned up, right? Those 30 people have turned up. It's the 400 people who didn't turn up that you should be angry with. But also, you've got to give them the best show that you can. I think there was, I did a couple of stand-up shows that were deliberately irritating. And it was, they were funny, I think, and they were good. A lot of people look back at them as being good, but a lot of people were irritated by them.
Which were your most irritating? Because I'm running through them at the moment.
I think someone likes yogurt, which had a whole half that was about me buying nine yogurts from a supermarket and the checkout girl questioning me and saying someone likes yogurt because I bought, and then me arguing that I didn't particularly like yogurt for sometimes up to an hour. That's a routine. That routine was actually okay. There was a routine about the Pope in that. I did all my shows again a few years ago. I did like 12 shows or 13 shows, whatever it was, in 6 weekends. And that was the hardest one to relearn, but also when I listened to it, just because it was 4 or 5 relentlessly battering away at an idea routines. And that was the one. I just think as a parent now, when you're one night out, might be one night out a month, and then to go out and see some prick just trying to piss you off. I would just think, I know, I'm not going to do that anymore. I will, I can do that in a small amount to enjoy myself. But, I want to be entertaining. I want to make the shows as good as possible. And I think the minute I was over that hump, then maybe 2005, 2006, where I was just thinking, where am I going to go? I just thought, no, you've got to be entertaining. You can be avant-garde, you can do whatever you want with it, but you've got to people have to be laughing. And that's the main thing. And so I think, that was a big thing. And then realising how fortunate I was. I think starting doing the podcast was a massive stroke of luck because it gave me something to do. It meant I could channel all my creativity into that, come up, do ideas that I didn't have to run past a committee and try stuff out. But also it meant I was introducing to an audience that, weren't aware of me. So then when I toured, my audience doubled from sort of 50 to 100 or 100 to 200, depending on which one it was. And that made all my tours financially viable, which took a big weight off. But also it meant I could really put my efforts into making those shows as good as possible, which then got more people to come and see them. I'm really proud of what I did with those shows because it was building, it was sort of starting from scratch and building an audience from nothing. And over a period of 15 years, I was sometimes playing to 1,000 people, and that was without really any TV exposure or anything. It was extra from the ones we had in the 90s. It was sort of, to know that I'd done that by people seeing the show and then saying to the mate, "Oh, he's back this year. Do you want? I saw this last year. Come and see it." And to do it that way, it felt real. And also, I became much, much better at doing the job and much, much better at understanding what the job was. And I think it's great to know Barry went through it as well. because he, you know, it shows everyone does it. If Barry went through it, it's because he loves comedy. But it can be a dispiriting thing, comedy, and it can be, and you know, usually in Edinburgh, even now, there's a couple of days where I'm very depressed.
Well, but it's hard not to look at... That's the thing, isn't it? The trick is, and it's a very hard trick, is not at any point to look at where someone else is.
Yeah, yeah.
And to look at someone else's... And there is... And I think in Edinburgh as well, in particular during the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, there is... I remember the year where the day before my show started, the basement flat that I lived in London flooded with excrement, destroying everything I owned. And someone came up to me and went, "You all right, Robin? How are you doing?" And I just found out, and I went, "Oh, not... just found out that everything I own has been destroyed by excrement." And they went, "I just got 4 stars in the Metro." And, you know, that kind of... Yeah, you have that going, "Oh, yeah, that's the world it is." And yeah. Some you find the allies as well, because once you can sit with people and they can say, "I'm not having a good time," yeah, or "I'm not," and you can go, "Oh, it's...
But I think that's that you don't realise that, you know, when you're playing to an art centre and there's 30 people, they think, "Oh, God, I'm failing." And then, because nobody comes up to you and goes, "Yeah, I got 12 people at that art centre." People bullshit or don't mention it. So when you talk things through... But, yeah, ultimately, the realisation that you are just trying to do... If you're competing against anyone, it's yourself. That's why I play myself at snooker. And you know, your only ambition should be to try and do something better or more interesting or more imaginative or whatever. And I think it's really important to keep on... trying stuff, you know, that means sometimes failing, and that means sometimes, you know, persisting with an idea that other people aren't liking. There's things I do that I know are my favorite things I do at the moment are clearing stones off a field and commentating about it, and the puppets, you know, doing the ventriloquist puppet show, and they're not to everyone's taste, but I think there's something really interesting in both of them. And they will only become incredibly interesting, especially the stone one, if it goes on for 20, 25 years. And then at that point, I think people will start to get it. Some people get it now, but I think there's something...
Yeah, you felt... Ronnie Corbett did it over 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You decided to do it over 25 years, yeah. The rambling, yeah. Shaggy dog, yeah, field, yeah. Clearing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, but I think, that, you know, it's such a lucky position I'm in. That, you know, money's coming in and I'm able to fund things with that money, and I'm also able to do esoteric ideas that nobody else would ever go near putting on if I didn't do it myself, and also do things that, you know, are more mainstream. So it's you know, that's for me the exciting thing about it. And comedy is such a rich variety of things, and it's very easy to just go, right, I'm going to concentrate on this one thing and really perfect this one thing. Or you can go, over a career, I'm going to have a crack at getting better at every single element of comedy. I think probably the only thing I wouldn't be able to do is what I'm interviewing John Culshaw tomorrow. I don't think there's any chance of me ever becoming an impressionist. Although now, yeah. What about an impressionist who can't do impressions at all, but really thinks he can? So, you know, there's something in it. So it's, you know, it's really... lockdown was weird, and again, I was lucky because we put all this stuff in place to maybe start doing a bit of stuff from home. And then I had all this brilliant equipment to record stuff from home. But just thinking, now I'm going to try and do something with this. I'm going to try ventriloquism. I'm going to see what happens with it. I'm going to not practice except in the show, and then just improvise an entire show. And there's lots of kids, younger comedians. I shouldn't call them kids because they're all in their 30s, really. But they do these improvised shows, and they invite me on their improvised shows. And you kind of go, you can just do an hour without any preparation. Which is the Spinal Tap thing. It's just, here's the idea, we're doing a book club, but it's of a book that doesn't exist that we're making up, or we're going to do an acting masterclass and you're not an actor, or whatever. Or you're going to do a puppet show with puppets where a man's having a breakdown and you're not quite sure if it's real. And he's not quite sure if it's real or not. That's enough, isn't it? It's sort of, as long as the thing's enough in itself, it doesn't matter what else happens with it. If it becomes a big success, then that's nice. And if it brings some money in, that's nice. But also if it's good and it's fun and, you know, 200 people like it, that's still quite nice, isn't it?
Well, that brings us very neatly to Tony Curtis. I'm just going to go, I've suddenly realised we only got to the fourth clip. We've not got long left.
Okay.
We'll move on. So you like Some Like It Hot, don't you?
I do. I love it.
Brilliant. That's
like
all we need. So let's have a look at Richard's clip from his favourite moment ever from Some Like It Hot.
And it's rare to get a film that just, it's just the best punchline to a film ever. And it's the writing in that is so amazing. All the way through that, I mean, all the way through the film, we just watch the writing, even the bit with Marilyn and is what's his face?
Tony Curtis.
Yeah, Tony Curtis. That's showbiz. It's just so crisp, isn't it? So brilliant. So I love the whole film, but it's. I just think to come up with a punchline to a film of that standard is impressive.
There are a few, aren't there? There's not many, but a few punchline films. Not always comedies. Escape from New York, for instance. John Carpenter has a punchline at the end of it with a jazz tape. Right. And the Alan Parker's Birdie as well has this huge build-up about mental health and all these things. And at the end, you think this guy who now believes he's a bird. You see him, his friend stopping these people, and he at the edge of a building, and he just falls.
Right.
And his friend goes, Birdie! And then he runs up, and it turns out it's just down one floor. And he goes, what? And it's the first time, and it's like the fact that you've watched 2 hours of a drama about mental health issues in Vietnam, and Alan Parker goes, and we'll end on a punchline, and that is, you know, pretty
not
brave
enough
thing.
Shifting of genres. That's why I want to do films that are serious for three quarters of it, and then suddenly turn into slapstick comedy. But yeah, we'll see. Yeah, but it's a brilliant film, obviously.
Well, we'll move on just so we can try and fit them all in. Now we're talking about John Landis before, and See You Next Wednesday, and you have chosen American Wealth in London again. I imagine you were putting on a voice to get into the Wells Cinema to see this one.
I'm sure I was. And again, there's some titillation in this film. Now, I love Jenny Agutter for all time as a result of the titillation in this film. And she's amazing. She's very funny and absolutely beautiful, gorgeous. But again, it's just one of those films. Rick Mayall's in this film, and that was just like blew my mind that Rick Mayall was in it. And I think when they did the premiere, all the kids were screaming for Rick, and no one knew because he's sort of just an extra in it almost. But it was going nuts. But yeah, just think again, it's that combination of genres, I suppose. But just to make this subject so funny, and I just watched this film in certain points until the tape became too cloudy to watch anymore. But again, the comedy of it is fantastic as well as the.
There's a lovely thing as well. You talk, of course, Rick Mayall, I think, is playing chess with Brian Glover.
Yeah.
And, again, another tremendous actor and part-time wrestler. And when he died, The Guardian, that was famous for its typos in its obituary, said that he died of a Brian tumour. And someone said he would have absolutely loved that. Well, he got the worst kind of tumour for a Brian. He got a Brian tumour. You know, that's,
you can't get through.
Well, this is Griffin Dunn as well, who is a fantastic... He's a producer, and he's done many other things, made a documentary recently about his aunt, I think it is, Joan Didion, as well, who recently died. But Griffin Dunn's timing in this, have you ever seen After Hours? Which I think is... Has anyone here seen After Hours? Martin Scorsese. I think it's one of the great... I'm surprised you haven't seen it.
Right.
It's not like a Martin Scorsese film in the way you'd imagine. It's just about a guy who has the worst night out ever in New York and everything just keeps going wrong. And right. Griffin Dunn, it's an absolute kind of screwball classic.
Yeah.
But we're not going to be showing that. Let's have a look at Griffin Dunn a few years earlier, American Wealth in London. It has that great moment, doesn't it, where they have they cut to the sex film and it's just someone ringing up. She goes, no, it doesn't live. Yeah, wrong number.
And I think that's the mother. Is that the mother of the guy from
Tiger Honeydrew, isn't it? Yeah. But it's a very interesting thing, as you said, because it's a proper gory film.
Yeah.
And you obviously see the enormous influence it had on Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, because Shaun of the Dead, similarly, is a proper, at times very emotional and gory horror film and a very funny comedy as well.
But it's lovely the way that those characters just react in different ways. So the guy from the tube's really angry, and the young couple, oh, hello.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's kind of nice just to have that characterization of how people would react. Really pissed off that you killed me, and then, oh.
The next one is you've chosen some Bill Murray.
Oh, yes.
When did you first kind of become aware of... I imagine you snuck in and saw the film Stripes.
I don't think I did see Stripes. I think I saw something like... is it called Caddyshack or something like that?
Caddyshack,
I think that was the first one I saw. Obviously, like, the Ghostbusters and stuff was when it sort of really permeated through how
Does Ghostbusters mean anything to you? Is it one of your films?
I like it. I don't think it would be... We watched a lot with the kids and stuff, and we watched all the various incarnations of Ghostbusters. And it's dated a little bit. It's a little bit rapey, it's like the Bill Murray character, which in Groundhog Day is at its peak, I think, is what's interesting. And he seems like, I like the fact he seems like a sort of prankster in real life and stuff. He's all these stories about him eating people's sandwiches and stuff and saying, no, no one's going to believe that Bill Murray ate a sandwich and stuff like that, so he'll get away with it. So he feels like he enjoys his fame. But yeah, there's just something when it's right. See, I think in Scrooged it's not right. They don't, and I sort
totally
of
don't, disagree. That's a terrible opinion.
I don't like Scrooge.
I think do you know what? I'm going to be honest, right? Ghostbusters means nothing to me.
Really?
I've never got it at all. I think it's the worst Bill Murray film, and that includes Razor's Edge, an adaptation of a W. Somerset Maugham novel, right? But Scrooged, I think, is absolutely fantastic.
Well, even in Groundhog Day, I think the Bill Murray at the start is better than the Bill Murray at the end.
Right.
So I think in Scrooge, I prefer Bill Murray at the start. I think him becoming all la 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 and oh, life's great ruins it. And in Groundhog Day, a bit. I prefer Groundhog Day where he doesn't ever escape. Yeah. Certainly than. No, because it's. But, you know, it's. I think Groundhog Day is just, again, a perfect comedy film. It's just a brilliant concept and absolutely fantastically explored. They've thought of every level to it. I have very slight reservations. Including the piano teacher at the end saying, he's my pupil, that doesn't make any sense. Because to him, he's a man who for some reason turned up on our door today able to play the piano perfectly and ask for lessons. So there's no, from her perspective.
It's annoying, isn't it, when you suddenly find a flaw in the logic of a truly improbable film.
Yeah. But someone did say that, someone tried to explain it to me and thought they'd found a reason to make it work. But there's absolutely no reason why he would have got that good at the piano. And then he might just have turned up to say hello, but she wouldn't take any credit for, unless she too was trapped in it and remembered everything.
Yeah, I know some people complained that at that point the film is set, that actually Sonny and Cher weren't getting played as much on the radio, okay. So actually it would have been a different song. Okay. And some of the other people have problems with some of the nature of the plumbing in that scene. And they're all dicks.
But aside from that, it's the perfect. Aside from it should be an unhappy ending, it's the perfect comedy film, I think, in terms of taking an idea and exploring it properly. I don't know which bit I chose from it, but it's...
Well, it's your favourite scene. It's the French poetry scene that you've gone on about so often. And I was hoping it was going to be the piano teacher. I'm disappointed. Here is Rich Herring's very favourite scene from Groundhog Day.
See, I refer him going, what a waste of time. I just love that even in that, him chatting up someone and even in that moment not being able to resist going, what a waste of time. I think that was the problem with my dating in the early days, is I probably thought, I'd be like Bill Murray and just say what I think.
So you want a kind of memento, a Christopher Nolan memento version of that film, which it plays backwards to your unhappy ending.
I just think he's cooler when he's, you know, and again, it's sort of weird ethically, isn't it, that it's a man abusing his position and, throughout the film he does different things. But, it is also, if you had that power, if you knew that the next day wasn't going to come, you would go through all the things he does. You would, you know, at some point, if it was, someone worked out it was like 10,000 years or something, he's been in there or something like that. It's, you know, we don't know how long he's trapped in that universe. But I don't like him. You know, I don't like the fact he changed, because the Bill Murray at the start is good, is great. And the Bill Murray at the end, who wants to live in that town. Fuck off.
Well, always, I mean, I know one of your, one of the drives to your comedy has been your hatred of kindness. And, kindness and learning are the two things you hate most of all. Repetition of yogurt, favourite thing. It's a strange career. I forget on a Bill Murray, the famous. I remember being years ago in New York and seeing the film Wild Things. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Kevin Bacon movie. And he's not on the poster. No one knows Bill Murray's in it.
Definitely.
And when he suddenly turns up on screen, the whole audience just went crazy. I mean, it really, the love that exists for him, even before that, you know, the later Oscar stuff and whatever.
Funny, but that's what, you know, because the things he does and the things he says, a different person could say them and it would be absolutely reprehensible, awful. And even in this day, age, some of the things that are politically incorrect you still like, because that's the character, and you still forgive him and you like him, and it's wit, and that's what Barry actually said about offensive comedy. It's just about whether you like the person saying it or not. If that's to take a joke out of context can make it look terrible, but if the audience loved the performer, they can sort of say anything. and the audience will understand why it's a joke. If you take it, the words, and put them in someone else's mouth, it could be a disaster, or just write them down on a piece of paper. But that's it. There's just something about him. You don't mind him being the worst human being ever, and you still, you know, you love. He's awful, really, isn't he? But you love him because it's honest, I suppose. It's just he's an honest, funny person.
Did you see Tim Minchin's musical of Groundhog Day?
Yeah,
I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I did. It was good. Yeah. It was. I mean, Matilda's amazing and rightfully still going. But I think Groundhog Day just like probably. It's, I don't know. Maybe it's just because people have such fond memories of the film. It didn't do as well. Did it? I think it might be getting resurrected. I saw Back to the Future the musical as well. That was
good. That's and that brings us very neatly to Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah, good.
So this is which is so. I mean, the intensity of love for the Muppet Christmas Carol. The number of people who go, if I could only take one Michael Caine movie, you know, Ip Crestfall and Zulu and Jaws 4 out of the window. And
the reason I've chosen this clip, and I love the film, and it's interesting. It's another film that didn't do very well on release, and has become much much loved, which I think is again a lot to do with comedy. A lot of times, the first time you see something, you don't necessarily tune in, and it takes a little while either to see a few episodes or really get in there, and then bang, it becomes this massive thing. I genuinely think this scene is the greatest acting Michael Caine has ever done. I think it's a very funny scene, but I think Michael Caine should have won the Oscar for this. I genuinely do, and it never would happen, but the reason this film works so well is he plays Scrooge entirely straight all the way through, and to play straight against Beaker. I can never not watch this. Another. It isn't really that funny a scene in a way, but it makes me piss myself every single time I see it, just because it's a scene. The scene is and it's true to the book. It's actually, I think, just verbatim from the book, but Beaker's in it. It's the best thing I've ever seen.
See, it now makes me want to see a Sesame Street version of Get Carter, in which, you know, Big Bird has to go back to Newcastle. That's what I want. Let's see all of these
things.
But
Beaker's very good in it as well, I have to say. Beaker acts very well in it as well, but Michael Caine acts very well against Beaker.
Let's have a look now at Michael Caine in Muppet Christmas Carol. That's actually your least favourite bit of Michael Caine.
Because Scrooge
realises the error of his ways. It's a terrible message in the film, isn't it? That a cruel man is bullied by hauntings into being something he doesn't want to be. It's a horrible story.
Well, you'll have to watch Muppet Christmas Carol again so you can see the right scene.
Now, Richard, I know you're not able to do impressions. Could you not do an impression maybe of Michael Caine, the scene we were going to see?
I can't really do it.
Let's just see how it
works. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
Brilliant. I've got to say, one of the funniest things ever is watching acts that can't do impressions. Because I remember there was a guy called David Mayling. I don't know if you ever saw him.
No.
And he would go on with... And he would just do all these routines where he'd go, this is Sylvester Stallone on a swing. Don't push me. Like that. But he believed he was doing really great impressions.
Good. Well,
and it was a magnificent thing to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, if he was collecting stones as well, it would have been something absolutely marvellous. So what was the scene you were going
to... So the scene is he comes in and it's all them trying to... When they're trying to get him to donate in the first place, and the nephew's there, and he's saying... It's all about reducing the surplus population, and the professor character's all very serious and going... And just Beaker's in the background going... And Michael Caine's just very, very unpleasant and serious throughout. But Beaker is very judgmental about, and surprised that anyone could be as mean as Scrooge, but gets that across in beeps.
I don't think we needed the clip. Let's not have any more of the clips. Now, I'd like you to reenact this scene from Bridesmaids. Now, Bridesmaids is I think he's an amazing director anyway. I think the last time we did this, when we did it online, showed a bit from Spy, which if you've not seen Spy, Melissa McCarthy... Have you seen Spy?
Yeah.
I think it's it has some of the greatest slapstick in it. And Jason Statham is brilliant.
He is good.
That has a great punchline as well, in which Jason Statham at the end of the movie is in a speedboat. And he just bids goodbye to everyone. He goes, well, maybe I'll see you again. Bon voyage. And then he just goes off. And then eventually they turn to him. does he know this is a lake? It's just a really great...
Maybe you need to be in a speedboat to make a film really work, the punchline of a film work. That's the rule.
But, yeah, Bridesmaids, so when did you see this in the movies?
I did see it. So my wife is absolutely obsessed with Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig and everybody. But I'm a big fan of Saturday Night Live, even as variable as it is, and there's so many people, especially from that generation of Saturday Night Live. I think it was Andy Samberg and Jason Sudeikis and stuff, and that have gone on to do amazing stuff. And I just think, it's sort of just proof that if it were ever needed, that you can do a film that's all women and it's very funny. But I think there's just this. Quite a lot of these Hollywood comedy films, I kind of got sort of annoyed with the improvisational. They all got a bit pleased with themselves about how improvised they were, and sometimes would show 15 versions of the same take, which might happen a bit in this film as well. But the improvisational elements in this film, I think, are really good. It's quite a long film, isn't it? It's a bit longer than it needs to be, I think. But I think it was sort of the introduction, I think, to the wider world of a lot of these fantastic actors who have again pretty much all gone on to be big stars in their own name, haven't they?
Yeah.
But I love Kristen Wiig, and there's stuff that she can just do with her face. There's a Saturday Night Live sketch of quite a recent one, which is about a family all getting loads of presents, but the mother gets a robe, and so it's like, I got a copy of Catcher in the Rye, and it just keeps on coming back to again, and I got a robe. It's very nice. It's in the sale. Thanks very much. They've all got all these, but it's her face. The way she conveys the happiness and the sadness of this situation, being the mum in the family not doing anything, is just awesome. So I think it's just how funny, when you've got someone who's that funny, they can sort of literally make anything funny just by the way they act. And I like it when she does in Saturday Night Live, they do the improvised songs. Mm. Where they're both singing a song that they don't know what it is, and then they both make it up as they go along. Saturday Night Live is worth watching. It's on Now TV. There's a lot to plough through, but the good bits are worth it.
Well, let's have a look at Bridesmaids, because this is a... it's also one of those films where they learn, but it's not cloying. I think, though, okay. I know you think it's a sad ending.
I don't like anyone to learn anything or improve.
And he is brilliant in the plane scene in Spy as well, with a name confusion. Right, we're going to try and get through all of them. So the next one is Bad Trip.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, let's have a look. So this is
This film is amazing, right? And again, Borat got nominated for an Oscar and is a very sort of... Because it's a bit more satirical and serious, this film is just... it's a kind of prank film... but it just shows people up in a really good light. It's about he goes having a breakdown across the country, basically, and it shows that people will sort of step in and help. I don't think this particular clip does so much, but it's really heartwarming because it's a prank show where the joke's on the person doing the prank, and then seeing how people react to it. But there's a story to it and a film to it, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's just funny all the way through.
This is really nice to watch, by the way, because I think a little bit like some of these movies you said you didn't like, you seem to be learning in the set as well. That negative Richard Herring we used to know. So let's have a little bit of this scene, which does not represent what you enjoy about this film. Okay.
Not all that great. It's not.
No, it's very, very similar to a scene in the Harold Lloyd film we showed yesterday. I take everything back. But now that, of course, goes straight into your next choice of clip, which is Charlie Chaplin's end speech from The Great Dictator. So I've never seen a simpler segue from one to the other.
Well, the reason I chose this clip is because I did a show called Hitler Moustache, in which I was attempting to reclaim the toothbrush moustache for comedy, because Chaplin had it before Hitler. And Hitler came along, kind of ruined it for everyone. Probably the worst thing he ever did. And so I grew a Hitler moustache that year, a toothbrush moustache that year, and to see what the reaction would be. It wasn't good. But it sort of made me look a bit into the history of The Great Dictator and Chaplin. And this is sort of a rare example of... I mean, it's not funny at all. This is him making a speech about democracy and humanity. But it's sort of very, and it came out at a time where America wasn't in the war. It's a very brave film for him to do. He was sort of told not to do it and did it anyway. And I think it probably generally did have an effect of getting, you know, helping get America into World War II, because I think it's sort of showing up what was going on. But it just sort of, I think it just shows where comedy can cross over that line into being sort of serious and being effective without, you know, it's an odd thing in a way, but it's sort of just to have a heartfelt speech at the end of, you know, a film that is still a funny film, and there's obviously amazing bits of physical comedy in this film. The stuff with the globe is amazing and beautiful, but this just to have like quite a long speech about what he thinks the importance of humanity is, and I closed my show by quoting some of this show as well, some of this speech as well. So it was, it's sort of fascinating, Hitler and Chatelain, because in a, you know, 10,000 years time, when archaeologists are digging up artifacts from either of those two guys, they're going to think it's the same person, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be the two people from the same time, both with this mistake. They go, this is some kind of symbol of either good or evil, or maybe both. It's comedy and tragedy together. I really wanted to do a play of, because they were trying to capture him, really. The Nazis were trying to get, would have liked to have caught Chaplin, but I wanted to write a play about if Hitler had won the war and Chaplin had been, you know, arrested and brought to Hitler, and the two of them having a conversation in that room with the globe in it. I might still do it at some point, but it's sort of, you know, I was fascinated by the way that the moustache is really, so, you know, becomes mm-hmm. about evil rather than about comedy. But, you know, he did this, and I think it's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, we showed the full Great Dictator on the day of Trump's inauguration, right, during Slapstick Festival.
Right.
And it's very interesting. A lot of people had never seen it before,
yeah,
and certainly never seen it on a big screen, the Colson Hall, and it was, yeah.
And he's not my favourite, you know, I wanted to put something a bit old, a bit from the era, and he's not my favourite of the sort of slapstick comedians either, but I just think, again, he just did some interesting stuff. He's not as funny as Laurel and Hardy, but he tried out very interesting things, like marrying a 16-year-old.
That was a piece of material he did more than once.
He tried it out.
The previous film's very interesting about that. The one bit that I will always, that I question about this, is when he says, we think too much and feel too little, I think the line is. And I think, I don't think overthinking is an issue with a lot of fascism and extremism. But let's have a look at Great Dictator. I think we should have had more clips in between the gorilla scene and that. But that's the way it goes, isn't it?
I think we should have gone straight into the gorilla thing after that.
Well, I kept then thinking about there's something about Mary and the fact that his hair... Anyway, look, there's... right, so, Richard Herring, these are all of your favourite films. You have no others, so that's the end of that. Richard, what time are you doing? Have you got another event today?
Yes, 12, is it 12 o'clock tomorrow at St George's? John Coleshaw, I'm doing basically Rahulastapa.
Brilliant, and that'll be... that will be fantastic. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Richard Herring.
You have been listening to a Rahulastapa special with me, Richard Herring, and my interviewer, Robin Ince. Thank you to everyone at the Bristol Slapstick Festival, especially Chris Daniels and his wife, who looked after my children in the cafe, and I'm sorry, they were such a nightmare to look after. They're good kids, really. I'm indebted to my producer, director and friend, Chris Evans, not that one. Thank you to everyone also at the Watershed for making this such a lovely, lovely occasion. And thank you to all the filmmakers for making those beautiful films that I enjoyed so much. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Come and see Rahulastapa live. Go to richardherring.com/gigs. You can see everybody who's going to be coming up in shows that are yet to come. You can also watch us live stream from anywhere in the world for this Leicester Square Theatre run. Go to gfsboxoffice.com. Buy your tickets, just £10 per evening. That's two interviews for just £10. And you can watch those shows at your leisure, either live or any time afterwards that suits your stupid life. Thanks for listening. Now go away.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.